Cool scientist Sean Dukas here. Good morning, Sean.
Hi, Declan.
And the latest in the world of science, and we'll see what is going on. It's in your genes, I believe, about your marriage and things like that. Is that right?
Yeah, apparently so. Good marriage can be partly.
Could I just say you celebrated 30 years last Monday?
Right. Okay.
30th anniversary.
I'm halfway there, like towards that eminent figure.
Anyway, I don't know what it's supposed to be, a 30th anniversary. Is it pearls or something like that?
Notion,
I'm afraid to ask, just in case there's consequences of going into some jeweler's shop or something. But anyway, that's enough of that. This particular story is as regards getting married and why a good marriage can or may be written in your genes.
Yeah, well, I mean, you're making it to 30 years, so you know you must have the good genes that are required, Declan, I think, at this stage. But not just yourself, obviously, your partner as well. And this is something that's come out of the United States, and it looks how at different genes, you know, these components in our DNA that seem to control so many things about us. And they've looked at variants of something called oxytocin receptor gene. That's OXTR, they call it, and its influence on married couples. And they've looked at that one because there's something called oxytocin people might have heard of. That's called the love hormone because it helps people to bond. So, you know, when you're cuddling or any kind of affection at all, there's lots of oxytocin being released, and that helps people to really bond with each other. So if you have a certain version of this gene that produces oxytocin, this can alter how much of the hormone, this love hormone, you have and when it's released and all of that kind of stuff, which means that it can impact on how people attach and care for each other, etc. And they tested the levels, the actual levels of the chemical, the love hormone, in people. And allied to that, then, they matched it up with interviews of 79 couples. I presume this was all done anonymously. I was thinking of myself if I was doing this. Asking them to rate how supportive their partner was during difficult periods of their life. And, you know, so those men, for example, that said their wives weren't particularly supportive at stressful times or etc., and they would have liked them to be more supportive, they actually then, fascinatingly, it matched up from their saliva samples that the levels of love hormone were actually quite low because they had a variant of this gene that actually wasn't enabling them to produce enough of this love hormone as and when it's required. So, you know, and it's not just the men, it's also the women. That the women that, for example, that said that had a perception that their husband was very supportive, so they actually had higher levels of the OXTR gene. So basically, you probably have a gene there, and your partner, I would say, that's firing out these love hormones, Declan. That's got you to 30
well,
years.
Well, there you go. Well, it's all written in the genes as such. Beer before wine may not be fine. There's an old saying about if you're going out for a night and you've got to be careful how you mix your drinks or whatever, or going to a wedding or going to some sort of celebration. What's the story here? Beer before wine may not be fine.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you do. That's the old saying, of course. And I always thought, gosh, is it not just to do with the amount of alcohol you have rather than whether you have beer first or wine
first? And then there's the spirits thrown in, and that's a no-no and all that.
Yeah. There's lots of kind of myths about this. So a bunch of scientists at Cambridge University in England thought, let's have a look at this. Let's actually test this to see if there's any basis for this saying. So they got volunteers aged 19 to 40. And I must say, I hope they paid them well, because they had to suffer hangovers, which is a fate worse than death, I think. But they were given a meal. And then they were split into groups, and one group basically drank 2.5 pints of beer and then 4 large glasses of white wine, and then another group had the same drinks in the reverse order. And then they basically gave them a drink of water and sent them off to bed. And then the poor people had to come back the next day and rate their hangover. God, we've all been there. And this, they've asked about thirst, fatigue, headache, dizziness, dizziness, nausea, stomach ache, fast heart rate, loss of appetite. These are all the horrible things that we are associated with hangovers. And they found that the first group basically had the same rating in terms of the hangover as the second group. And that this, of course, meant that whether you had your pints first and your wine then, or your wine first and your pints then.
No difference.
No difference whatsoever.
Back to, it's
but
the amount.
What they didn't mention was that there's a difference. It's not actually in this study between men and women, which is quite huge, that men are physically able to take more drink because they've essentially got more places to put it in their body. And it doesn't, you know, this has been proven time and time again. You know the way you have a pint and a woman used to have in the old days have a glass? Well, actually, according to the science, and women won't thank me for this, but they only should have a third of a pint. Because the men, it just physiologically are better able to cope with it.
Right, so you're not getting into a war there. You're just saying, this is the science.
This is the science.
Okay. Right, that'd be much cheaper bringing somebody out, wouldn't it? Yeah. She'll only have a third, okay.
She'd have to water.
But anyway, I'll extricate myself from this one as we move on to chimps, chimpanzee sign language. There's a human connection here.
Yeah, I know a bit about sign language. I had a granny who was deaf and I didn't know it that well, but my father and all my uncles used sign language with our granny, so I saw it in action and, you know, it's kind of fascinating. And what they found is that chimps essentially use sign language too. And there's two rules in sign language. One of them is, well, in language generally, that if you, words that are used quite a lot, like the or to or things like that, that are used in language a lot, they're short. So there's a kind of a shorthand that you use, and that also applies to when you're signing. And they found that with the chimps, they seem to have a shorthand in operation with their signing. The chimps, of course, they can't speak, but they use these gestures like deaf people. And they also found that they use noises, of course, and they use gestures and facial features, and that essentially they're at about the same level as your average toddler, because, you know, if you've had a toddler, they'll stamp their feet if they want something, or point, or do various things to get attention, and the chimps do that, and then they have this very rudimentary sign language that they're using as well, which seems to obey the same kind of rules of language that we have, but they don't actually speak. So there you go, they are able to communicate.
Good, okay, yeah. Fascinating, chimpanzees. Mm. Now, one more, and this is about an Irish guy from County Kildare who lost a ship. And people went out looking for it. So
what an amazing
that
story. Shackleton. Anybody who likes an adventure, of course, knows about Ernest Shackleton and the endurance. And it's in the news a lot recently. BBC are very interested in it. Of course, he's Irish. He's been claimed as one of the great Victorian explorers.
From near Castle Dermot, someplace.
Yes, down that Kildare-Carlow border.
Yeah.
And he's Irish. But, of course, we're part of the UK then. So he's seen as a British Victorian explorer.
Yeah.
But off he went anyway to Antarctica. And he wants to cross Antarctica, the first people to cross it. This is 1914. And his boat, called the Endurance, excuse me, got caught in ice down there in the Weddell Sea, which is a really nasty sea, one of the worst seas in the world, apparently. And it got locked in ice, and it drifted for 9 months. And then after a while, there was a hole formed in it, and water got in, it was crushed. And then they had to get from there in the lifeboats. They dragged the lifeboats across the ice, and they went to Elephant Island, which was an island there. And then Shackleton famously went off in one lifeboat 1,000 miles to South Georgia, landed on South Georgia, walked across South Georgia, climbed a mountain and went down to a whaling station and managed to get everybody back to safety. It was just an amazing story. So people have always wanted to try and find Endurance, the ship, because they think it might still be in okay condition because it was made of wood. So you'd think it'd be, gosh, there's nothing left now at this stage. But the microorganisms, the bacteria and the things that would normally devour wood, because it's so cold, they just don't operate in those waters. So they reckon that it's in pretty good shape. Now, the problem with it is it's about 3 kilometers down, right? So they have a pretty good idea of where it is, because the navigations, the navigator that Shackleton had was brilliant. You know, everybody knew this guy was brilliant. So he made a recording of the last place the ship was before it sank. So they think that's where it is. But then they went and sent this AUV, this scientific mission, I should say, was not down there for the endurance. They were down there to look at the ice. And basically, we all know the ice is melting. And they thought, well, seeing as we're here looking at the ice shelf, let's go and see if we can find Shackleton's ship. So off they went, and they put down this AUV, this automatic autonomous underwater vehicle, it's called, to go search for it. And it was looking around for about 30 hours. It couldn't find it, and now they've lost track of it completely. It's disappeared, and it probably has pictures of Shackleton's endurance boat, but the rover is now gone, and there's no wireless link or anything like that. So the pictures are now down there on the bottom, and they're gonna, at some stage, I'm sure somebody else will have another crack at this. But the boat is still down there. We think we haven't seen it yet.
Okay, thanks very much indeed, Sean. Sean is the cool scientist. Journalist and author, involved writing his book at the moment and doing lots of work around the world of science in Ireland. And thanks for dropping out to us this morning, Sean.
Thanks, Declan.
Very good. The marriage one particularly. Very good. All right. It's the Morning Show at East Coast.